Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic on the 10 westbound, the 24th Street exit ramp is blocked. Also, watch out for a vehicle fire on the 202 eastbound Red Mountain Freeway at Gilbert Road. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 73. Partly cloudy tonight. Overnight lows near 50. Sunny and 73 again for tomorrow, up to 76 on Wednesday. Sunny skies over Phoenix right now, 72 degrees at KJZZ. High-level officials will arrive in Nogales tomorrow to mark the launching of a new program to streamline transportation security at the Arizona-Mexico border. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Tucson, Michel Marisco reports.
Last summer, the United States and Mexico experimented with a program to inspect cargo trucks at the Nogales shipping port. Those were for trucks heading north into Arizona. Wait times went from about 3 to 4 hours down to 30 minutes. Now the two countries are introducing the same program to southbound cargo trucks, with American and Mexican inspectors checking the trucks together. It's one of the few places along the border where the two countries collaborate in security inspections. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey and U.S. Ambassador to Mexico Roberta Jackson are expected at the event. From Tucson, I'm Michel Marisco.
The Maricopa Community College District has been taking feedback on a proposed reorganization, which could include some consolidations. KJZZ, by the way, is licensed to the Maricopa Community College District. With me to explain what officials are considering is Maria Harper-Marinick, the district's chancellor. And Dr. Harper-Marinick, first off, what was the impetus for this proposed reorganization?
Well, the system has been in place, as you know, for decades. And changes have happened around us, including changes in the in Maricopa County, which is the county that we serve. We have challenges when it comes to funding and the generation of revenue to support the system. The original concept of the colleges serve that community and only that community, that has changed. That's not reality anymore. We have students going to multiple colleges. We have colleges that serve what we call a region as opposed to a local community only. Obviously, we do that too. So what we are proposing is basically a transformation of the structure of the system to serve the community on a regional basis and leading to programmatic decisions that may not be viable today with the current system because we don't have the resources.
And part of that, it sounds like, would be sort of separating the administrations into regions of the Valley of Maricopa County. So you'd have an east region, which would take care of some of the colleges, a west or south, et cetera. How would that affect operations? How would that affect students?
I don't think it will impact students' day-to-day life at the colleges. What would be impacted is how we make decisions. So yes, so the proposal is to take the county in a regional manner, as you described, geographic distribution of the administrators, so that we can make better decisions as a system and not make decisions that are only impacting a college. We make decisions as a region.
You mentioned challenges with funding, and I'm wondering where else you're going to look to save money. I mean, college presidents obviously tend to be fairly expensive, but by themselves, getting rid of a few of them probably won't solve the district's money issues. Are you looking at reductions in force? Are you looking at voluntary early retirement buyouts, that kind of thing?
We're actually not really looking at that right now because those are not easy decisions to make. Some of them are policy decisions that a chancellor shouldn't make by herself. I think that we need to look at consolidation of services. We need to look at consolidation of programs. And I wouldn't necessarily say that leads to the reduction in force necessarily. What could happen is if we have people retiring, maybe we need to be more thoughtful before we replace everyone who retires. But that's not a reduction in force where we're basically letting people go.
Consolidation, though, people hear that word, they think redundancies, they think, okay, correct. If you have three people doing the same job, you don't need all three of us.
Well, and that could be. and that could be moving forward. It's not the intent right now. What's driving, and it shouldn't be, is not only restructuring, is not only releasing resources by not having as many presidents, is actually strengthening how we serve the community in a more systemic way. Now, we all know that we need to be more entrepreneurial, and that is one of the components of this model moving forward, is that as a system, we need to look at other ways to increase revenue, and that's why we are also have restructured our Maricopa Corporate College.
One of the criticisms, as I'm sure you've heard of this plan, is that it's kind of short on details, that people don't really know exactly what's going to happen. And especially folks are concerned, as we've discussed, about potentially losing their jobs, losing their livelihoods. What is the time frame for sort of fleshing out some of those details and letting all the employees, students, administrators of the community college district know in more concrete terms what's going on?
That's a good question, because I have not presented a plan. I have shared a vision, and it's a conceptual vision of what the district could look like. If I were to present a detailed plan, I would be dishonoring our promise to the employees and the community that we are going to be inclusive and that we respect shared governance. So people have interpreted what I have proposed as a plan that doesn't have any details, but there is no plan other than there is a vision. And so what I have said is we need to have a phased-in approach to implementation, that I would put a group, an ad hoc group, that would be representative of the community and the employees, all employees, faculty and non-faculty, and administrators to help us decide what is a prudent way to implement moving forward. What we have done so far is just put the vision out there because the governing board is desiring to adopt a resolution. I had to provide context for why there is a resolution in the first place.
So I guess maybe the question then is, when do you expect to start hearing some more of those voices? I know you've had some meetings and public hearings, for lack of a better word, already. When do you expect to maybe set up some of those committees, start maybe formulating a plan? Because if you're going to implement something, presumably that would be in the shape of, here's exactly what we're going to do.
Correct. Absolutely, yes. So the meetings were to allow the board to inform the public that they have an intent to adopt a resolution and then to hear questions. Quite a bit of feedback has been provided. So again, I provided a context for why the board is looking at that resolution. And now I will, beginning this week, try to decide who should be on an advisory board or task force, more than a board, and then begin that development of the implementation plan of the vision that I provided, probably beginning in January.
Dr. Maria Harper-Marinick is Chancellor of the Maricopa Community College District. Dr. Harper-Marinick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A cut in lifetime eligibility for a program called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF, basically cash assistance, has created a shortfall at the agency that oversees social service programs. Rachel Leingang wrote about this in the Arizona Capital Times, and she joins me. So, Rachel, what's going on here?
Because of this drop to 12 months, a lifetime limit in cash assistance, there's now a $9 million shortfall in a different department within the Department of Economic Security, the one that oversees child support services. So because of that drop in cash assistance, there's sort of an unintended consequence of a shortfall in another area.
How did that happen?
When people go on cash assistance, by law, part of the money that they would get in child support payments goes back to the program that gives them cash assistance. It's sort of a way that the program can pay for part of what it provides to people. So basically, TANF recipients turn over their rights to child support collections while they're on TANF. So because of that, there's been a shortfall in child support services because there's fewer people now who are on TANF. So there's fewer people whose child support collections would be turned over to the state.
Is this something that lawmakers who voted for this realized was going to happen?
It's unclear. It definitely was never discussed when this came up. It came up in budget negotiations in 2015 and then went into effect in July of this year. And throughout that whole process, obviously there was a lot of talk from Democrats and from social service groups saying that this would hurt the economy in ways that we didn't foresee, you know, including kids who might end up neglected because their parents can't adequately take care of them. But this specific line item here wasn't mentioned, and the discussion was fairly short.
So what's the solution then? Is DES asking for more money to make this up?
Yeah, DES is saying that they need $3 million from the general fund to bring in $6 million more from the federal government, from match dollars there. And if not, that their services for child support could be, I think they said, severely impacted. So that means that they could have less luck trying to find people who still owe child support. They can't help people establish paternity in disputes or, you know, serve court orders, things like that. Different services that the state supplies to people who are trying to get non-custodial parents to pay child support.
Is DES asking just for a lump sum, or are they looking to restore any of the cash assistance eligibility?
They didn't bring up the topic of restoring or bringing back up that lifetime limit for cash assistance at all. That was never mentioned in the budget request. And when I asked why they didn't recommend that, they said it wouldn't get them the amount of money that they would need to fill the shortfall. What they had said that if they increased it back up to 24 months, which is what the lifetime limit was before the drop in July, the shortfall for child support would be decreased by about $1.7 million when you combine state and federal match dollars. So not enough to make up that, you know, $9 million that they're short at this point.
Rachel Leingang is a reporter for the Arizona Capital Times. Rachel, thanks.
Thank you.
President-elect Donald Trump has announced he plans to nominate Washington State Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers as Interior Secretary. That agency has a significant impact on Arizona, and we have two perspectives today on her nomination, starting with Patrick Bray, Executive Vice President of the Arizona Cattlemen's Association. And Patrick, what do you think about Congresswoman McMorris Rogers as the President-elect's pick to lead the Interior Department?
I think we are definitely looking forward to working with the new secretary. And we are certainly excited at the direction that President-elect Trump is headed. And I think that we will have a chance here to really start managing the issues we have within the interior on public lands and the endangered species stuff, and head in a direction where we can make our public lands go to work for us in rural America.
What kinds of things are you hopeful that an Interior Department led by Representative McMorris Rogers would do with public lands that hasn't been done so far?
I think that there's some large issues facing Interior at the moment that they have to start to deal with. And I think we're living in a new era where we can start to think outside the box. But by doing so, we have to get closer to the ground with decision making. So right off the bat, I think the Secretary needs to take a hard look at BLM Planning Rule 2.0 and really pull that back from the table and look at planning on our public lands at closest to the ground. And that means, working with collaboratively the people that impact them. That's your public land ranchers, that's your rural American communities, and that kind of stuff. That's kind of a big piece there. And then the Endangered Species Act under U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service there, actions that they take, and how we're going to protect species moving forward, but make sure that the socioeconomics is also considered in those decisions of listing, and that we're not doing single species management and looking only at how do we save the species at the detriment of business and other things. So there needs to be balance restored in that area.
When you talk about using public lands differently, would I be right to assume that grazing leases would be a part of that?
Absolutely. I think grazing leases are an integral part of public land management, and they have to be a part of the discussion, just like other permitted activities.
When you talk about endangered species and looking at, you know, sort of balancing all the different needs, how much of that is related to the Mexican gray wolf reintroduction program?
It's the direct correlation there. And I think the Mexican gray wolf program is a prime example of a program that is failing and that the secretary needs to deal with quite rapidly. I mean, you look at Mexican wolf, but then that can be lumped into wolves across the United States and the population concerns that we have. And if you look at what's going on in the Great Lakes and up in Wyoming, where they can't even get listing and they recovered the population, it doesn't look good for our Mexican wolf moving forward. And so we have to look at, really, we would like our wolf delisted as well, and proper funding for those that are impacted by the recovery of that species.
Patrick Bray is Executive Vice President of the Arizona Cattlemen's Association. Perhaps not surprisingly, some environmental groups are less excited about McMorris Rogers as the new Interior Secretary. Sandy Barr is Chapter Director of the Grand Canyon Chapter of the Sierra Club. And Sandy, same question, what do you think about her nomination?
Well, obviously, we are very concerned about this selection of Representative McMorris Rogers. Her environmental record is very poor, has like a 0% on the most recent scorecard, League of Conservation Voters scorecard, and her lifetime average is not too much higher than that. She's supported selling off public lands, and for us in Arizona, that's of particular concern.
Is that sort of the biggest concern you have? Are there other policy areas in which you think there might be problems?
Well, public lands is a big issue because the Secretary of the Department of Interior has a huge role in what happens with our public lands, whether it's national parks, Bureau of Land Management lands, wildlife refuges. And of course, also has an impact on what happens with endangered species and a multitude of issues. And she has demonstrated little support for environmental protection overall.
What are your concerns about what might happen to them, that they might be privatized and sold, they might be given back to states, the federal government might choose to have other uses for them?
Well, all of the above. I mean, the privatization is of concern. That's something that she supported a bill to sell off public lands. She also supported legislation that would have taken away the authority of the president to establish national monuments under the Antiquities Act. And that's, you know, that's something that has been used for a very long time in Arizona to protect our public lands. She supports an agenda that is totally contrary to what really was started by President Theodore Roosevelt, and that is, you know, protecting these lands, and, you know, some of which have become national parks.
Of all of the issues that were discussed at some point or another during the presidential election, the issue of public lands and national parks was one that, at least I can't remember anybody really talking about in a debate or on the campaign trail all that much. Do we have a sense, do you have a sense of where President-elect Trump stands on that issue and what some of his priorities are in addition to his recommendation of Representative McMorris Rogers to lead the Interior Department?
Well, this appointment of McMorris Rogers is really contrary to what Donald Trump said when he was out on the campaign stump. You're right, it wasn't the subject of debate. But when he has expressed opposition to this goal of getting rid of public lands and has expressed some support for, you know, hunting and fishing heritage and a lot of the hunter-angler groups throughout the country have been advocating very strongly for keeping public lands in public hands. I think we really don't know for sure where he's going to go with this.
Sandy Barr is director of the Grand Canyon Chapter of the Sierra Club. The University of Arizona's work in astronomy and space sciences is the accumulation of a century of work. In fact, it was 100 years ago that the first money was donated for an observatory. It became known as Steward Observatory, named for the donor's husband. For KJZZ, Sarah Hammond details the history from the Arizona Science Desk.
In 1916, philanthropist Lavinia Steward of Oracle made a gift to the U of A to help pay for an observatory. A century later, Steward Observatory is unrivaled in astronomical observations and making mirrors for the world's largest telescopes. U of A astronomer Thomas Fleming is the institution's resident historian, among other duties.
So that $60,000 really started the ball rolling, especially on the research side. because it provided an instrument where astronomical research could be done at the university.
The money was a godsend to physics professor Andrew Ellicott Douglas, who wanted an observatory to rival Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, which he had helped build. It took 6 years from the time of Lavinia Stewart's donation to the opening of the observatory with a 36-inch telescope.
Professor Douglas, even before he dedicated the observatory in April of 1923, as soon as that telescope was built, he wanted people looking through it. Not just students, but members of the community.
Douglas began evening public lectures, which continue to this day. He selected the right place, as Fleming notes, saying Tucson is ideal for this science.
Arizona and Hawaii are the only two states in the United States where the lighting conditions and the weather climate conditions are still reasonable to do state-of-the-art astronomy.
Fleming teaches astronomy courses to U of A students who are not planning to be scientists but who need science credits.
The Department of Astronomy and Stewart Observatory teach more students in the Eller College of Business than the College of Science.
That's a lot of growth over a century, including a time just 60 years ago when the faculty was so small that astronomy students could get personal instruction from the department chair, Edwin Carpenter. Michael Chris attended West Phoenix High and had the astronomy bug. He wanted to study at the university in Tucson.
So 1952 is when I came to the university as a freshman. There were only two permanent people and one part-time person on the faculty in astronomy. I turned out to be the only one majoring in astronomy.
Chris recalls arriving for class in the lobby of Stewart Observatory and
Dr. Carpenter, whose office was on the second floor, he would come down, and there I'd be at a table, just a regular table and a chair, cane back chair, that kind of thing, and he would lecture. He would lecture as if there were 100 people out in front of him.
Chris says Carpenter's teaching style inspired him to become an astronomy professor. He spent his career at colleges in California. He retired to Tucson, and 4 years ago, he became a lecturer at Stewart, teaching the philosophy and history of astronomical thought. Now, Stewart in the astronomy department attracts students from all over the world, such as junior Rafia Bushra.
I'm from Bangladesh, and I came here because I wanted to study astronomy. It is one of the top-ranked astronomy programs in the country.
Bushra is working alongside astronomy professor Marsha Rieke on a camera for the James Webb Space Telescope that will launch into space in 2018. Stewart Observatory's influence reaches far beyond the U of A campus. Its telescopes are in operation throughout southern Arizona and in Chile. The work done at Stewart over the years spawned other scientific disciplines at the university, including creation of the science of tree ring research and a lab that makes mirrors for observatories around the globe. And there's the Lunar and Planetary Lab, which is a leading NASA research center and which mapped the moon for the manned landings. All that and more from that $60,000 gift one century ago. For the Arizona Science Desk, I'm Sarah Hammond in Tucson.
Lists of regions considered high-tech hotbeds often include the same names: Silicon Valley, the Research Triangle of North Carolina, the Route 128 corridor in Boston. But a new report shows those lists should be expanded and that Arizona should be on them. The data come from the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, a nonpartisan think tank based in D.C. Rob Atkinson is the group's president, and he joins me via Skype. So, Rob, when you looked at IT jobs and the industry itself across the country, what kinds of things were you looking at and what were you hoping to find out?
Technology is reshaping the economy, and it's doing it in all sorts of different parts of the country and all sorts of different sectors. You're getting now smart manufacturing, smart transportation, healthcare. And yet there's a view, certainly among a lot of experts, but also policymakers, that the tech economy is really something that's just only in a few places in the country predominantly. And so what we were trying to find was, is that true? Is the tech economy concentrated, or is it more broadly distributed? And what we found was it was more broadly distributed.
And one of the places in which it is perhaps more broadly distributed than a lot of people would think is here in Arizona.
Yeah, absolutely. Arizona has a number of strengths. They're in the, as a state overall, they're in the top half on a number of different, or close to the top half on a number of different indicators. For example, high-tech exports, science and engineering workers, all sorts of different things where you have some real strengths in Arizona that, again, maybe people or even policymakers or members of Congress might not have been fully aware of.
To what do you attribute that?
Well, I'm not a huge expert on Arizona, but certainly you have two leading universities. Arizona State in particular has done some really, I think, very stellar things under the leadership of President Mike Crow. Intel had a big plant there. You had a Motorola. So at least the Phoenix area, you've had certainly a strong semiconductor industry. And the other component of that, too, it's close to California. And so there's linkages between Arizona and California. It's a nice place to live. You know, people who tend to move tend to have more education than people who stay behind. And so Arizona's been able to attract people. A good example is high-skill immigrant workers. Arizona done pretty well there.
You also looked at some of these measures by congressional districts in the state. And one of the things that struck me was that most of the congressional districts in Arizona were ranked in the top 50 in some category or another. I'm wondering what that tells you about the state, given that it seems like what you're looking at is not just concentrated, for example, in the Phoenix metro area, but really throughout the state.
Yeah, and that, you know, Arizona in a way is a microcosm of the country there. I don't want to say that every single state has a congressional district that's, you know, doing well in the technology economy, but a lot of them do. So again, there it's interesting that Arizona has different, there are different parts of the state that have different strengths.
When states are looking to build up this industry, how big of an impact does perception make? You talked about how there's sort of this general perception that places like Silicon Valley, Boston, Austin, Texas, maybe, have this perception of being really high-tech hubs. So I'm wondering if a place like Arizona, which is generally not necessarily thought of in that category, does that hurt in terms of trying to bring companies in or start up some of those things that you're talking about doing?
Yeah, certainly at the margin it does. Perception becomes reality. People look at, is it going to be dynamic? Is there a lot of action going on with regard to technology? You know, one of the things I think the state could do is it could try to really be a technology leader. Things like making Phoenix the smartest city in the world, really using technology to transform government. Doing those things have some effect directly on the tech economy, but more importantly, they give a message to the rest of the world that this is a place that really understands technology. Our elected officials understand it. We want to go forward. And that's really very helpful in terms of getting a better tech reputation.
Rob Atkinson is president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. We'll post a link to his group's report at theshow.kjzz.org. Rob, thanks a lot.
Okay, my pleasure.
In a check of international news, Taiwan could soon become the first place in Asia to recognize same-sex marriage. In October, legislators from both the ruling and opposition parties introduced bills that would legalize it. Taiwan is considered the most accepting part of Asia for the LGBT community, but there's been growing opposition, especially from religious groups. They're demanding public hearings and even a referendum. The BBC's Cindy Su reports.
We've known each other for 6 years. And we've been married for
2 years.
Yes, since 2014.
Being gay is something that's natural and what we're born with. Now is the time for the law to be passed. We were both aware that we like women at a very young age. So it wasn't something that's affected by environment or, you know, bad influence or popular culture.
To learn to crawl before you learn to stand.
Meet one of Taiwan's newest types of family, mums Cindy and Lana, son Shaughnessy, and daughter Daenerys. Cindy conceived the twins using her and Lana's eggs and a donor sperm. She gave birth to the babies this year. In recent years, Taiwan has become much more open to homosexuals. Observers say the island's democratization, starting with the lifting of martial law in the late 80s, spawned a gay rights movement that has raised public awareness and fostered acceptance in society over the years. Now, Taiwan could become the first place in Asia to approve same-sex marriages like Cindy and Lana's.
We are a pretty democratic society. So when people approach us on the street and they will ask us, you know, whether we're sisters or what's our family, where's the daddy? And we tell them, like, very frankly that we are a gay family. This is my partner. We're married in Canada, and these are twin babies. And for most people, you know, when we go to the market, or it's like people who are around 50 or 60 year old grandmas, and they've never heard of such thing. They're like, wow, I didn't know that's possible. And their reactions are mostly, wow, that's cool.
Why do you believe that it's so important for Taiwan to legalize same-sex marriage?
We know like more than 100 couples with kids. I'm sure there are gonna be more and more family exist that we don't know. So that's why we think it's very important to pass a law to protect the family like us.
Polls previously showed more than 50% of Taiwanese people think same-sex marriage should be legalized. But opposition is growing, and opponents have been holding many rallies like this one. More recent polls indicate the public may have become more cautious, with support now standing at a little over 40%. Religious groups say it would change the nature of families. They say schools could promote homosexuality by teaching about LGBT people, and youngsters might experiment with being gay. This protester voiced why she opposes gay marriages.
This is the rationale of the heavens. From the beginning of mankind to now, it's because of one husband and one wife that there are you, me, and the entire human race. So that's why we oppose same-sex marriages.
To try to please both sides, the Ministry of Justice is drafting another bill aimed at granting some rights for same-sex partners, but stopping short of legalizing their marriages. It's believed to be more acceptable to the opponents, but the gay community says it would isolate them. Supporters of legalizing gay marriages, meanwhile, also have been holding rallies. They say they resent the fear-mongering and say that gay marriages should be treated equally under Taiwan's marriage law. They insist gay couples should enjoy the same rights as heterosexual couples to adopt children, inherit each other's assets, and be regarded as parents of their children.
That's the BBC's Cindy Hsu in Taiwan. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Phil Latzman.
And Mark, the Arizona Air National Guard base on the south side of Sky Harbor Airport has now been renamed in honor of the man who founded it 70 years ago.
That would be five-time Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, who was also a pilot who served in World War II and was an avid flyer. He helped activate the fighter squadron at Luke Field in 1946. The unit moved to Sky Harbor in 1952.
His son, Barry Goldwater Jr., remembers those days. He grew up flying in his father's lap in the cockpit of the Piper Cub that his dad purchased after the war. At the dedication ceremony of the base in his late father's name, Jr., a former congressman himself, discussed flying and some present-day politics.
Well, it's very emotional because he's my father. And even though I lived most of that time with him, it's always nice when people get together to honor him. And this is an exceptional occasion because he was so much involved with the Air National Guard. For them to do that was very touching.
I think most people know him as a distinguished U.S. senator, as somebody who meant a lot to Arizona in so many ways, but maybe don't know him as that pilot that you grew up with flying with.
You know, he was an eclectic kind of person. I mean, he did so much. He was a photographer. He had a huge interest in ham radio, but he flew. He loved flying. He had over 10,000 hours. Flew all over the world and promoted aviation. So this was near and dear to his heart, and to be recognized for it, I think he would be touched.
What do you think he would think of the year 2016 and all the things that have happened this year politically, and his name being raised in certain circles in referring to it.
You know something? I think he'd be amused. I think he'd be very amused and very pleased that the Republican Party, at the last moment, came together and provided the kind of support that our Republican candidate, Donald Trump, required. But it was an unusual election, and I think he would basically be amused by it. But he'd be very supportive.
Would he have been amused with Donald Trump and some of his comments, or would he be a little concerned?
You know, I think he looks at the bigger picture and not get caught up in the minutia of the personality called Donald Trump. You can't get overwhelmed by what the president-elect says. You got to listen to the bigger picture and the broader picture of what he's doing and what he's trying to do. So I don't think he would get upset one way or another. I think he'd, again, be quite amused by it.
Time magazine has Donald Trump as the man of the year, but of the divided states of America. Do you think these are the divided states of America? As a former member of Congress, how do we reunite them?
I don't think it's any more divided than when Barack Obama got elected. We have this every 4 years. And I think it's commendable that there's so much passion out there during this election. I think it speaks well of America's democracy, that so many Americans become passionate. And there's nothing wrong with that. And nobody says one side is right or not. It is part of the political process. And you don't want to get so emotionally tied to it that you forget to look at the bigger picture, and that is we're all in there together to protect and fight for our freedoms and to have a commander-in-chief and a president who's our leader. Whether it's a Democrat or Republican doesn't make any difference. We have elections, the process works, we have a new president, we get behind him and hope for the best.
And that's KJZZ's Phil Latzman speaking with Barry Goldwater Jr. You're listening to the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
I never get emotional, but to have my name called and send it to great players, I'm overwhelmed right now.
Louisville's Lamar Jackson surprised no one in taking the Heisman Trophy over the weekend. The trophy traditionally rewards the best college football player, and it's mostly gone to team-leading quarterbacks down through the years, with few exceptions. Those quarterbacks have nearly all been white. Jackson is the sixth black quarterback to win the Heisman. Cam Newton, who led the Carolina Panthers into the Super Bowl last February, said, quote, "I'm an African American. That may scare a lot of people because they haven't seen nothing they can compare me to," end quote. Newton has also said NFL officials have not been making calls to protect him during games because he's black.
William C. Roden, a writer-at-large for ESPN's The Undefeated, wrote the book Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. Roden says, whatever the record books say, it has been uniquely hard for African-American quarterbacks to find success in the NFL.
The quarterback position in football, I think, defines everything that black men are not supposed to be. Tough, grace under pressure, intelligent, smart on their feet.
Leader in the locker room.
Positive trait you can mention is what black men and black people are not supposed to be. And it's sort of... it all coalesces at this one position in our great national pastime, football. The quarterback always has the ball. All eyes are on the quarterback. If you look at the National Football League, almost every other position, wide receivers, skill positions, almost the entire defense in the secondary and defensive backs, now are almost African-American men. I mean, almost to the point of the starting lineups at any given time be almost 98%. African-American, except one position, and that position is a quarterback position, and I think, you know, the powers of people trying to kind of hold that back for a long time, and so I think that it's a very interesting cultural dynamic that's still at play.
Let's start with Russell Wilson. Mm-hmm. Here's a brilliant quarterback, an extremely talented quarterback, an athletic quarterback, and also somebody who's flexible in the pocket. But he doesn't talk a lot. He doesn't speak up. And in America, if you're the African-American who just keeps his mouth shut, you're perceived as, oh, he's smart and mature and he doesn't say anything. You're Cam Newton and you like raise your hand, you're suddenly the uppity N-word.
Mm. But I think even with Wilson, he's been to two Super Bowls and came within a bad throw of winning two. Even with that, people are still saying, well, you know, he really can't throw from the pocket, and constantly doubting him. This is about leadership, and it could be, you could go through almost any corporation, you know, where an African-American is in charge. And there's the same doubts, the same second guessing, whether it's Dean Baquet at the New York Times or Ken Chenault at American Express. You know, there's this thing about black men, Barack Obama in the White House. There's this thing about, you know, black people, black men in charge in positions of leadership, which brings up, I think, the worst of who we are as Americans. And I think it's just manifested in football with a quarterback position. So I think that it's just.
Well, I love the way your mind is racing, because I'm thinking of Colin Powell. A man in charge, four-star general, but he's forced as Secretary of State to give the bogus rationale for going into Iraq. And it's essentially he gets punished for being the team player.
Yeah, and he's the fall guy. And I forgot about Colin Powell.
And he's the African-American fall guy.
Yeah. And so I mean, we could look at it just as a football issue, but it's not really a football issue. Football just happens to be what we're talking about. So I think that when we talk about Cam Newton, I think that what Newton's complaint is that I'm not being afforded the protection. Andrew Luck, they would not allow Andrew Luck to get beaten up like this. They would not allow Tom Brady, Philip Rivers to get beaten up like this. And I think that therein lies his complaint. It's not that this isn't a brutal game, it's not a brutal sport, but there's a certain protection that you have given these elite quarterbacks that you are not giving me.
When you mix racism in with money, maturity, youth, and the pressures of the NFL, I mean, are you looking at individuals who were African-American quarterbacks who had a certain amount of success? Randall Cunningham, you mentioned. Warren Moon's another we could talk about. Do they carry a burden of being a pioneer?
Yeah. I mean, listen, Warren Moon spent, you know, he was an All-American at the Pac-10 at University of Washington, had to go to Canada for, I may be getting this wrong, 7 or 8 years, had to go to Canada just to come back to get a shot. You know, Warren Moon went through therapy. Even when he came back and played, he went through therapy because of all the stuff that he had to take and hold in just to play a stupid position of quarterback. Cunningham preceded Moon, but even then there was sort of the burden of how he was playing, because he was so outside the norm with his running and that kind of stuff. Later in his career, he sort of stayed in the pocket. Interestingly enough, a guy like Donovan McNabb took a lot of heat because his game was running and being mobile and getting out the pocket. But there was always, he wanted to prove to people, I could stay in the pocket. That's the sacred cow of quarterbacks in the National Football League is the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
That's the holy grail of you know, the courageous white male standing in the pocket, taking the punishment and all that. But now you've got this breed of quarterbacks, and we've had different, you know, from Michael Vick to Cunningham, Randall Cunningham, you know, who basically are the greatest athletes on the team, and they run, they move around. So what we're talking about here is really of something that's been going on a
long time.
Yeah,
heavy burden. Yeah. William Roden, former columnist for the New York Times, now writer at large for ESPN's The Undefeated, author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. Thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
And that's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
Filmmaker Ron Howard and actor Tom Hanks recently teamed up for the third film in the series based on Dan Brown's novels about symbologist Robert Langdon. The plot of the movie, Inferno, shares something in common with the Inferno from Dante's Divine Comedy, which was written more than 700 years ago. So why is there still modern interest in the story or its lessons? To learn more, I'm joined by Fabian Alfie, professor in the U of A's Department of French and Italian. Fabian, why are so many people still fascinated by what Dante wrote?
Well, Dante, he's tackling the big questions. He was a Christian writer of the Middle Ages, and so it's tapped into the big questions as taught by Christianity, that is to say, the nature of human depravity, evil or sin, depending on how you want to define that. And then what is human nature? And then ultimately about transcendence. So he's really approaching it from the viewpoint of asking these huge questions.
Here's the million-dollar question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we so fascinated by questions that we probably can never answer?
Well, I guess that really comes out of being a human being, isn't it? I mean, we really do ask these big questions of what is our role? Who are we? What does it mean? As we go through life, we all have to make decisions that are, you know, later in retrospect, we look back upon and we go, well, why did I do that? And so we really do find ourselves asking, who are we? What are we? What does it mean to be a human being? It really comes down to the human experience, in my opinion.
I wouldn't think human nature has changed, but our experiences are so different, whether it's technology, whether it's just dealing with an everyday life or the stresses and whatnot. Does that naturally have to impact how Dante and his works are seen today, whether it's in a blockbuster film or something different?
Well, yes and no. I mean, he wrote it for readership of the early 1300s, and he said it in the year 1300. And so in that regard, he's talking about a culture, a city that was developing at the time with the technology, with the cultural teachings of the time. And so in that sense, yes, it is very historically grounded in a time of 716 years ago. On the other hand, what he's really asking is, you know, what are our impulses? I mean, his hell, for instance, is organized around the natural human impulses, lust, gluttony, greed, and so forth, at least to a certain point. Well, what are these impulses? They haven't changed. And so therefore, he's asking a question, as you said, about human nature that hasn't changed, even though clearly our culture, our society, our technology, all of those aspects have fundamentally changed. You know, we live in a world that we like to think of and probably is much more humane than the world of the Middle Ages. And yet those same drives that drove inspired individuals at the time, they haven't changed in the slightest.
How much do we actually know about Dante? Was he someone who was given to hedonism and more extreme impulses, or was he more of an observer of those?
What we know, he probably was both, like most of us, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, he was born in 1260 in Florence. Florence was a booming city at the time, as most of Italy was booming. This is a city-state in a peninsula of city-states. Most of, contemporary American readers or listeners will understand that, if you know, through Romeo and Juliet, the context Shakespeare was describing was actually absolutely real, the fighting in the streets, the weak city governments that couldn't control the nobles. Dante did write about love poetry early in his youth, and so therefore we can assume he, you know, was involved in terms of a life of, shall we say, of the flesh. He later got involved in politics, and so he would have been aware of, you know, what motivates human beings, but also what constrains them, that is the fear of punishment. And then later in his life, he was, for political motives, exiled, and for much of the last part of his life, he's wandering from, you know, court to court, city to city, with people who will support him as he was writing his Divine Comedy. And so that, I give you that background to say, you know, a little of all of that. He was a scholar, so he would have been studying at the time. He would have understood human motivations, but he also would have experienced them. We do have references to, for instance, illegitimate children and so forth. So, as I said, you know, an observer in all senses of the word, you know, that is, he would have experienced it, but also he would have learned about it from a remove.
Fabian Alfi is a professor in the U of A's Department of French and Italian. He's been explaining the long-running popularity and impact of Dante's Divine Comedy.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.